Welcome to the October podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pynchon. The October issue is on the topic of neural tube defects. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Shenandoah Robinson of Harvard University speaks with Dr. Peter Carmel of the Neurological Institutes of New Jersey. They discuss Dr. Carmel and colleagues' paper, Lipomyelomeningocele, Pathology, Treatment, and Outcomes, a review of the literature.
Good morning. This is Dodie Robinson. I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon at Boston Children's Hospital, and we are going to discuss the topic of lipomyelomeningocele today with Dr. Peter Carmel, the professor and chair of the Department of Neurological Surgery at the University Hospital of New Jersey Medical School. He's also the former president of the American Medical Association. And Dr. Carmel and his colleagues have provided a nice review of this topic, and we're going to discuss some of the pertinent issues this morning.
Well, good morning, Dodie. It's nice to hear you. What we tried to do in this paper is to go over the basics of the pathophysiology, the embryology, the presentation of kids with lipomyelomeningocele, and then to cover the various influences that the lipomyelomeningocele will have on the development of those children and how you follow them. And then what tests you can do prior to the operation, both diagnostically and physiologically, and then to look at the intraoperative testing that might be involved, and then finally, how do you evaluate these children in the years going forward?
All right. So over your career, how have the advances in neuroimaging and other studies such as urodynamics changed how we evaluate and manage these kids?
Well, it's hard to exaggerate the degree to which things have changed. You're too young to remember, but there was a neurologist in England by the name of Lorber who published criteria of when you should operate on kids with myelomeningoceles and lipomyelomeningoceles and when you shouldn't. And that he had a set of criteria whereby he could allegedly determine how that child would turn out in the future. And that was not greeted with a warm reception by American neurosurgeons, because we have a much different attitude towards children with disabilities. We have a strong feeling that the decision on when to operate and when not to operate, although guided by the input from the physician, is still basically up to the parents and guardians of the child, and in later years, of course, by the patient themselves. And so that was not well received. And in the United States, many, many more of these children were operated than they were, for instance, in England. And in fact, the outcomes were very much better than Lorber had initially described. A few of the things that have increased the lifespan of these children and made them more useful in their life have to do with the prevention of the orthopedic and urological deformities that take place with myelomeningocele. From the neurosurgical point of view, these lesions were terrible to operate by a headlight and loops. They were very hard to visualize what was neural and what was scar, and it was hard to determine intraoperatively what was viable nerve function and what was not. and the introduction of really high-powered microscopic visualization was important. Then when you're removing the lipoma, the old ways of cautery and cutting with the scissors were extremely inefficient and quite damaging to surrounding tissue compared to the use of the ultrasonic aspirator and now the use of laser, both of which have really changed the operative efficiency and safety in operating on lipomyelomeningocele.
Has the MRI made a big difference?
Well, of course, diagnostically, there's a huge difference. It is very hard to visualize the anatomy of lipomyelomeningocele on CT and almost impossible on plain X-ray. So that the idea of being able to delineate the neural structures preoperatively and the ability to visualize in the sagittal plane have been enormous changes for the operation of lipomyelomeningocele. And more importantly, for the following of lipomyelomeningocele and for picking up the various operative complications, subcutaneous CSF collections, and things like that. And it is important to remember all of the changes in ultrasonography that have gone on in the last 20 years, so that the antenatal diagnosis of lipomyelomeningocele has really improved. And the 3D ultrasonography and using different planes for ultrasonography of the spinal cord in the fetus are huge advances in the antenatal diagnosis. And then, of course, I think it's almost impossible to think about an operation without getting a really good, high-powered MRI so that you can determine where the cord is, where it might be tethered, where the roots are pushed to one side or the other, and the operative asymmetries of these lipomyelomeningoceles very much influence the way you operate.
So if you see an infant in your clinic with a newly diagnosed lipomyelomeningocele, what's your thought process in terms of whether to operate and, if so, when?
Well, that, of course, is a controversial process decision. But, in fact, I think there is very good evidence from the literature that children progressively lose neurological function with lipomyelomeningoceles that are unoperated. There are excellent longitudinal studies that show that the degree of neurological impairment shortly after birth rises dramatically in the first 6 to 8 months of life and then continues to go up at a slower pace in the years afterwards. And so I think there's an increasing tendency to operate on these children early rather than late. And by early, I don't mean that this is an emergency that should be done on day of life number one or number two, but to move along with the diagnostic studies, get the views that you need for operation, find out something about the function of the kidneys that you need to know, find out what the bladder is doing, and to try to get some assessment of the degree of neurological damage, and then to move to operation. And generally, I try to operate these children within the first month of life.
Okay.
The problem is, of course, in the way referrals happen in this real world, is often you see these kids at 3 months or 5 months or 8 months or 10 months, and the general rule I followed is, let's see how early we can intervene.
And you mentioned the importance of follow-up. when you're following the older children, say you have a child that's ambulatory with fairly good bladder and bowel function, who then comes in with, you know, some back and leg pain, how do you proceed with that?
It's important to remember that when you go in and you repair the lipomyelomeningocele and you think you've performed a good untethering, when you look at the post-op scan, the MR, the cord doesn't roll up like a window shade when it's untethered. It remains pretty much in the same position. And in fact, it's a minority of cords that show some upward migration as the child gets bigger. The majority stay pretty much where they were when you operated them originally. When you look at the MR, they can look retethered 1 month post-surgery. And in fact, I don't think they are retethered at that time, but the MR doesn't give you the information you need to evaluate that. So the decision on whether something should be done for a kid with new symptoms is entirely a clinical decision. There is some objective evidence that you can get from urological studies and urodynamics. There is some information you can get through EMGs of the anal sphincter. There are some clues you can get by electrophysiological studies of the legs. If you have a good baseline of both the urology and the electrophysiology of the legs, you can compare the new studies to the old ones. And if you see deterioration, that's a clear indication for you. But by and large, that decision is not made as much on objective evidence as it is on clinical evidence. And a kid who acquires new neurological deficits is a warning sign. What's difficult to evaluate, and I think you were alluding to it when you asked the question, Dodie, is the kid who comes in with symptoms of pain but without progressive neurological deficit. That's a very, very hard thing to manage. In general, we try to manage pain alone with physiotherapy and being extremely watchful so that we are far more likely to get closely spaced 3-4 month examinations of the legs and neurological function in a kid who has leg pain. But pain alone is not necessarily an indication for operation. They're all kids with tethers who become highly disabled by their pain. And in fact, in that case, pain alone may be an indication for doing an untethering operation. One of the nice things about untethering operations as far as pain goes is that it is the symptom that is perhaps most responsive to operation. And operation has a pretty good likelihood of relieving pain if it's due to retethering. And, of course, the symptoms that are likely to recover are motor strength and then sensory exam. And the thing, unfortunately, that's least likely to recover with untethering is loss of bladder and bowel function. For the child who has pain alone, it's important to remember that not all of the pain may be due to neurological nerve pain. A lot of these kids have major structural problems with the lower end of their vertebral column, many with their hips and pelvises. And so it's important to distinguish the pains that are due to structural problems from those due to neurological problems.
And what advice do you have to young adults that have a history of a repaired lipomyelin meningocele?
It's important to know that kids with repaired lipomyelin meningoceles can live absolutely normal lives. And the aim of everybody who takes care of that child or young adult is to restore that patient to as full functional ability as possible. This is not a surrender to the pathology at all. You have to make sure that your kids know that you expect them to have good lives. You and I both know a very important, famous neurosurgeon who has a lipomyelin meningocele with corresponding bad orthopedic problems with legs, who has gone on to have a brilliant career in neurosurgery. And so for these kids, the sky's the limit, but they have to be followed carefully, and they have to have someone who is going to rigorously see that all of the various specialties that are involved in their care are seeing the patient and that the patient is being followed as carefully as possible.
Is there any role for folate in terms of prevention of these, like if a young woman is planning to have a child of her own?
Yes. We know that the presence of a myelomeningocele or a lipomyelomeningocele is influenced by a number of antenatal factors, including nutrition. And there is no doubt that adding folate to the diet of pregnant women does decrease the incidence of myelomeningocele. It's not quite clear that lipomyelomeningoceles are decreased by introduction of folate in the diet, but folate for pregnant women is certainly a strong therapeutic option.
With very few side effects.
With few side effects and with potentially great improvement in outcome for the fetus.
Yeah. Do you have any other comments?
Well, I think that we are just seeing now a generation of kids with lipomyelomeningoceles who have had the benefit of this recent spurt in technology that the field of neurosurgery has seen in the last quarter century. And improved technology in urology and orthopedics and physiotherapy and physiatry as well. And so the outlook for kids with lipomyelomeningocele is progressively better as time goes on. And for the people who undertake the care of these children, it's important that you be responsible for everything that's happening with that child. And all of the different specialties have to be cognizant of what's happening with all of their colleagues in the care of this kid.
I think that's an excellent point. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
This concludes our podcast for the October 2012 issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the November issue, when the topic will be Risk Prevention and the Surgical Checklist. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group on Twitter and now also on Facebook.